Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross, our 250th time together. Kind of a milestone. If you are of Scandinavian descent, Jim Leary is a guy you should know about, and we're going to help that happen. He's a specialist and educator on all things Scandinavian and co-directs the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He finds and archives some very cool stuff. He's coming up. Jim Oliver brings us a look at the first production of the Red Barn Theater's 53rd season through the eyes of director Terry Wiesner. Brent Hensel is the curator of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. Brent grew up in Black River Falls and received postgraduate education at UW-Eau Claire. We'll learn what that job's all about. We should all know what the Sierra Club is all about. We'll get a pretty good idea in a discussion with Steve Skoll, who stopped in for discussion about the regional club and their fundraising bike ride this Sunday. And let's depart the tarmac to get this baby off the ground right here. Sometimes we don't rescue the landmarks in time. They get torn down and are gone forever. Not so with part of an historic structure in Eau Claire. Most of the building goes, but the part that served as a lofty, familiar marker has been preserved, thus carrying on an institution begun nearly 65 years ago. It's the Pagoda Spire, atop what once was Jimmy Woo's on Hastings Way in Eau Claire, the fate of which was still up in the air last month.
It all started when official proposal for the site came before the Eau Claire Planning Commission.
That's John Vanek, a staff member at the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire.
It immediately became an urgent project because the new CVS drugstore that's supposed to be built on the site had a very accelerated development plan. So demolition was going to commence by June 1st, and that gave the community about a month to figure out what to do with this unofficial landmark, this icon of an old business district. I don't think people were prepared for the outpouring of support for the structure, even if it couldn't be saved. There were a lot of people who called in, both here and to local news agencies and on social media,
sure,
to save it, but other people also shared stories about living and working near the pagoda with its original owners and later about how that landmark served to mark sort of an entry point into Eau Claire along Hastings Way. We even got a call from a woman whose father for many years helped maintain the pagoda for the Wu family.
And when did it open?
It opened as a restaurant on August 31st, 1950. It was one of the main business districts from the 1950s through about the 1970s. The pagoda helped center that as a landmark within that new business district.
And not only did you have an outpouring of rank-and-file people who had memories of it and wanted to see if something could be done, you had an outpouring of people who could help you technically to make it happen.
Absolutely. As these discussions got underway, people like Jeff Nelson of Dell's Architectural Antiques in Eau Claire and Ken Zier, who sits on the Eau Claire City Landmarks Commission, helped to investigate whether or not it could be saved. Some people did, at least just from looking at the wood structure on the outside, believe that it was likely to just fall apart if we tried to lift it off. But we did get some volunteer architects and preservationists, salvage people, to look at it, and it was indeed a sound steel structure underneath the weather-worn wood exterior. And then we also had help from Dick Hayek, who has 30 years experience salvaging other large and historic things. And he was the one who really helped to quickly gather together a bunch of volunteers with professional experience to make the move a reality.
You were able to just either unhook it or cut it off and lift it off.
Right. The top tier of the pagoda model was removed.
Okay.
And then they were able to access the steel structure from the top, and then just cutting it off from the building gave the same access to the bottom. It actually moved pretty easily, you know, volunteer crane operator onto a flatbed truck.
So what are the plans for it?
It's in a temporary home right now because this all came about so quickly. It will eventually make its way to the Chippewa Valley Museum in Carson Park in Eau Claire. Specific plans are not yet set. It will come down to money and timing and, again, having the help to move it. But the owners and the realtor currently in possession of the building agreed to offer it as a gift to the museum if the removal could be arranged quickly, and that's what happened.
That's wonderful. And you know, it really doesn't matter that the specific plans aren't drawn up yet, because I think most of us are just happy that it's safe and sound and didn't succumb to a wrecking ball.
Right.
That's a great story, John. Thanks for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
John Vanek, Chippewa Valley Museum. As Spectrum West continues, you know, in radio, it's rarely a good idea to have a guest on the program with a more resonant voice than the host. But in this case, the Sierra Club, I'm going to toss aside my superciliousness and welcome Steve Skoll, who visited the other day with news about the popular Sierra Century Bike Ride coming Sunday and a refresher on the important work of the Sierra Club itself, about how he got involved.
My wife and I raised a family up here in the woods north of Colfax.
Okay.
And as they dissipated and moved on, we thought, we need new blood in our lives. Let's go find some new folks. We had done 4-H and FFA as members, as leaders, as involved folks. And we found the Sierra Club. And they're a good group of people that have common interests.
It's pretty cool that this came up because it refreshed my knowledge of the Sierra Club. I went online, of course, and looked it up. Shame on people in Wisconsin if they don't know the name John Muir, huh?
I would say. It's true. I can't tell you how long he lived here, but he was definitely a Wisconsin resident.
Early on,
yes.
Yeah, he came from Scotland, I believe.
Right.
And then Portage, I read, is where he settled first, his family. He went to Yosemite, went to the Sierra Nevadas. It entered his soul, and it never left. That's the way it described him. I thought that was pretty cool. Does the Sierra Club of today remember him? Is he revered?
Absolutely.
Is there, okay.
Absolutely. It's all about his legacy, I think.
Okay.
Or at least maintaining ties to the thoughts that he embodied.
Other than meeting people, what about the Sierra Club appeal to you? You must feel some social responsibility.
Well, there is that. I think that as folks, we just seek other like-minded people in our lives, and we can get behind each other's causes.
I may very well ride in this thing now that I've heard about it. I think that would be fun, and I love the cause.
The cause is a worthy one. The local chapter of the Sierra Club here, there's 8 chapters in the state. Ours covers about 12 counties, and I think that probably includes most of the listening area of this station.
Mm-hmm.
The signal carries quite a long ways.
Good.
But our chapter covers almost the same territory.
Uh-huh.
What we do is we don't ask a lot of money from folks to come ride in this bike ride, and we just turn it right around and redistribute it to people that are doing environmental projects in the community. A group from Chippewa Falls wanted to take some kids out to see what a landfill is.
Good
so
idea. Yeah.
We helped them hire a bus and make a field trip, find out what is a landfill and what is recycling, and for elementary school kids. Mark Mosey up in Colfax does streamside work on the Red Cedar River with his biology classes.
Mm-hmm.
And we've given him some money over the years. And Julie Kaler up at Bloomer this year got some money to buy some kayaks for a lifetime fitness program at the high school there. So we turn it right around and put it back into the community, usually through school projects.
And that's where most of the funds for the bike ride will go, to the school projects, yes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we funded some guys from Duluth, one of whom is a native of Menominee.
Mm-hmm.
To ride their bicycles to Quebec City. They skirted the edges of the Great Lakes all the way around.
Wow.
Put in over 5,000 miles. And we helped them with their video equipment purchase.
Oh.
Helped sponsor them. And they have in turn come back. And we just had a program with them. They came down from Duluth and gave us a presentation. And when they get the video completed, they're going to come back with that too. Big Lakes Bike. If you wanted to Google Big Lakes Bike, you would find out what these guys were doing. What's neat about this ride that we do out here at Beaver Creek, you choose a size of ride that you want to ride and go ride it.
In the studio with us, Steve Skoll, we are talking about different things. The Sierra Century Ride is Sunday, starts and ends at Beaver Creek Reserve. But we're also getting into the Sierra Club, which is something that more people should do. Is get into the Sierra Club. Conservation and environment have become political footballs in America. That's kind of sad, isn't it? You know?
I would say.
Yeah.
In the state of Wisconsin, we have such a tradition of wondrous places mm-hmm. and thoughtful stewardship.
The home of Gaylord Nelson, for gosh sake.
Aldo yeah. Leopold, Gaylord Nelson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This has been a state that has been a bellwether for sound cooperation, for maintaining what we have, and it needs to maintain that.
Yeah, it was a responsibility at one time. I mean, all things natural, you'd think that all things natural we could agree on.
Wouldn't you?
I would think that. I don't know why we do. Is there a major focus of the Sierra Club today? Because we're talking about several things. I mean, we're talking climate change. We're talking recycling. We've been reminded recently how much of a trash barrel the oceans are. Transportation of oil, fracking. Do you guys get into one or all of them?
I think we're probably conscious or at least aware of everything that mm-hmm. goes on and try to encourage all of those topics. It's a panoply. We have people in our group that have focuses on a lot of these things. Independently, there's just so much you can do in the course of a day. So we have a lot of folks that have a lot of different kinds of focuses and interests, and they bring this to our club.
You have I'm guessing you have a strong, robust membership in all
of these. I think we do.
In the local Sierra Club, but you can always use more?
More is better.
Yeah.
I think our mailing list is something over 500 people locally. Okay. And we have a strong turnout we have meetings in the fall of the year through the winter and through the spring. We have monthly speakers come, and we find good folks to talk about things that are interesting, and we get together, and we have interesting discussions.
Cool.
And have a good time.
Now, Sunday's Sierra Century Ride is for people who really like to bike, and it's also for people who really like to bike. As I said, you can go anywhere from 12 to 100 miles and take your pick. Hmm?
What is it, 12, 30, 60, 80, and 100?
Yeah.
Choose a ride and go on it. We have support vehicles, sag wagons. We've got three of them out, making certain that folks are in good order.
So most people know where Beaver Creek Reserve is. How far out do these routes go? Do they go basically around the area?
The 60, 80, and 100-mile rides head down to Osseo, down through Fall Creek. And the 100-mile ride does a 20-mile loop south of Osseo below the freeway and comes back.
Okay.
We have a fair number of riders that come out from the Twin Cities to join us every year. And then the local, the Pi riders out of the Eau Claire area will do or the 80 or the 100. And it's for anybody that has a bicycle and wants to just go out and make the wheels turn. There's one woman who has been corresponding with me who says she's going to start early, probably before everybody else, just because she wants to see if she can do the 100 miles.
Wow.
And I said, great. There may not be anybody at Osseo when you get there.
Yeah.
But they'll be there by the time you come back with some refreshment for you.
Yeah, bring some panniers full of
water
stuff.
And whatever else. But nobody needs to do 100 miles. 12 miles is a good ride.
That's a good ride.
30 miles is fun,
too. It's a wonderful ride. Today, as this is airing, we are already past the early registration date, but all that means is that you're going to contribute an extra $5 to the Sierra Club because you can do it on the day of easily.
Yes, absolutely. Just come on out, bring your checkbook, your water bottle, and there's a meal. Anybody that rides or anybody that turns up and is hungry at the end of the day at Beaver Creek is welcome to have our burritos and ice cream and whatever else we happen to have.
You start at your leisure?
You start when you feel like it. Registration runs from 7 till 10 in the morning.
Oh, okay.
We figure that the folks that are going on the longer rides can show up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice ride. They cover a lot of ground. They cover a lot of different kinds of territory.
It's called a Sierra Century Ride. A nice thing to do, and an even nicer thing to do is to consider being a Sierra Club member because it does wonderful things and will do even more wonderful things as time goes on.
I think so.
Especially with lots of new members. I am now considering becoming a member. I'm inspired now. See, that's what this program does for me. Thanks, Steve.
Well, thank you.
I can hear it now. Steve, wasn't that Garrison Keillor? The other thing that you should remember is, probably bring a helmet, huh? If you've always wanted to participate in an organized bike event but were intimidated by numbers or distance, this is the ride for you. It's the 15th year, I believe. Eleanor Wolfengang started it all. Ride at your own pace. Starts, finishes, same place. Beaver Creek Reserve. Rest stops. Good cause. Sunday morning. See you there. Sierra Century Ride.
Support for WPR comes from the Water Street Deli in Eau Claire, offering fresh hummus, baba ganoush, and pita chips. Available at the deli, the downtown farmers market, and just local food. On Facebook and at waterstreetdeliandgrocery.com.
Spectrum West, good to be with you. I'm Al Ross. Where are we? There we go. Bring that down a little bit. Hey, why not have a theater in a barn? A red barn at that. It's a concept that's been going strong and enjoyed by Spectrum and Wisconsin Westerners for over half a century. So who do you send to get that story of experience? Why, you send another whiz at community theater, Jim Oliver.
Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant, a musical comedy written by Phil and Paul Olson, has opened the 53rd season at the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake. The show runs nightly through June 7th with no performance schedule for this coming Sunday. Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant is directed by Terry Wiesner, who is theater director at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County and a regular actor and director at the Red Barn. So welcome back to Spectrum West.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, this is the fourth in the Don't Hug Me musicals written by the Olsen brothers. So how would you compare it with the previous three?
The storylines are, you know, using the same characters, but they continue to grow with new and different challenges. We were remarking in rehearsal that there is kind of a pattern that follows, but they all have their own unique, every show that they've written has their own unique style about what they're talking about. This one happens to be about the fact that Clara is pregnant.
Well, that's certainly throws in a monkey wrench, as I recall, something about the synopsis of it, that this happens in the middle of the winter, too. So.
Well, it happens in October, and in Bunyan Bay, anything can happen, just like northwest Wisconsin. It can snow in October, and they get a good snowstorm.
Ah, okay. Well, we won't go any further than that, because we want to give up all the story.
So all roads are closed, they're stuck at the bar, and my goodness, Clara just might have that baby at the bar.
Gosh. So this is a musical. As I remember, the brother Paul, who is the physician, writes the music. And
yes.
Then Phil, who is the actual playwright, I guess you could call him, writes the story and the lyrics.
Yeah, they kind of do it differently in that Paul sends the music to Phil, and then Phil writes the dialogue and words to fit in. Usually kind of goes the other way around. We were really lucky last year. He was doing a reading in Eau Claire of his next play, and we invited him to come up and see our production of Don't Hug Me, a County Fair last year, and he did come up and talk to the cast and crew, and it was really nice to meet him, see, you know, I kind of asked him, well, what's it like to watch your work performed by so many different groups? And he said, you know, I really don't concentrate on the groups. I'm thinking and wondering, are my jokes going to still work? You know, do they mm-hmm. still ring true?
Uh-huh. The titles of the music are always fascinating. Kind
the different
of,
songs, yeah.
Yeah, they're amusing in themselves. Can you
and
give
yeah,
us such a...
they do a different style. You know, they kind of use different styles throughout. There's the love song. There's the rock and roll song. There's a rap within it. There's, you know, just a tender, nice song. There's some silly songs, obviously. But many of them are funny and yet still touch on a lot of the emotions that many of us go through in life. The audiences will love them. They do have to listen because mm-hmm. the dialogue within the song is very specific. So, yeah, there's a lot of answering back and forth within the songs. It's almost like a dialogue written into the music rather than just like a poem set to music.
This is done in Midwestern dialogue, which wasn't really popular until fairly recently.
Well, yeah, I think Fargo was the one that really kind of hit the map for everyone, and they went, oh, yeah, I remember people talking like that. Yeah, there, hey. Oh, for goodness sakes. Yeah, so plays well for us in the Midwest up here because this is who we are, who the people we are reminded of. And so I'm always surprised that he can open these shows in Los Angeles, and they still do well. They really like the humor, they like the music, they like the characters. We're excited to do the fourth in the series. I think there are five.
Well, according to their website, anyway, there's a fifth in progress or something. Yes. I'm not sure how that goes. Anyway, look, a little bit about the technical side of the writing of it. I'm sort of fascinated by some plays which are written for a specific region tend to be written in a way that it just pulls you into that dialect. Once upon a time in an earlier life, I read counterpoint for some auditions of a play set in Ireland, and I found myself reading the lines and, you know, picking up an Irish brogue, and I don't speak an Irish brogue. It just doesn't happen. And another one was Our Town, which is in New England, and you suddenly found yourself, you know, speaking in a New England kind of dialect.
Oh,
am I way out of line here, or is that
no,
true?
No, I think that is with any kind of a production like that, whether it's a British accent, a Southern accent, a Texas drawl, a New York accent. As we work on these and we read them, we start to absorb the character, the story. We start to hear those words, and they start to become part of us, and we do take on those dialects, definitely.
He is Terry Wiesner, who is director of the Red Barn Theater production of Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant. Well, tell us who's in the cast of the show.
Well, we have our regulars. Clara and Gunner are played by Nancy Erickson Dutmer from Chautauqua, and Dr. Mark Nemo of Rice Lake plays Gunner. Knut Gunderson is the local businessman, if you will. He's kind of a silly character. He gets a little dark in this show, but it's played by the actor who's played him four times for me, Jackson Liddle from Barron. Everybody loves Jackson. He's just a crazy, crazy character on and off stage. The other male character is Arvid Gislason. And Arvid sells karaoke machines, so that's how he's connected to the bar. He's put the karaoke machine in the bar. It is a lifestyle system karaoke machine, and that character is played by Ben Heer of Rice Lake. And the last person we have to mention is Bernice, a former waitress for the bar, and now she's gone on to do things, singing in her own career, and has not been as successful. She didn't make the cut for American Idol. She got beat out by a stripper from Duluth. but that is played by one of my current students, Gabriella Ashland from Rice Lake. So I have the two mature actors, and then I have one current student and two other former students in the show. So it's really great to work with friends.
Oh, sure. Now, you're able to recruit actors to come back and play similar roles in the different versions of the Don't Hug Me stories?
Yeah, I certainly could do that. I have chosen not to because these folks are available. As soon as the one show comes out, they say, hey, are we going to do that one? Are we ready to do that one? Or what do you think? So, they're eager. They're almost edging me to do it. I think the biggest one we had to try and convince this time around was Nancy to become pregnant. She said, you know, I'm too old to be pregnant. And we're going, oh, no, you're not too old to be pregnant. So that was the biggest hurdle, I think.
Uh-huh. Wonders costuming can do, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
Speaking of costuming and other technical sides of the show, what kind of a technical crew do you have?
Well, the Red Barn has our own costumer, Jennifer Albrecht from Chautauqua. But she kind of bows out on certain shows. She wants a little bit of her summer for herself. Mm-hmm. And so the cast has kind of come up. She's done some specialty items, some baby bonnets and things like that that are necessary. But other than that, it's been pretty much the cast themselves.
What kind of musical background do you have?
None. I mean, I had accordion lessons for 5 years as a kid. But I've done musicals. I read a little music. I'm not that great at it, but this show is all self-contained. The show comes with a CD for rehearsal and then a CD for the performance.
Oh, okay.
So it's all run through the karaoke machine on stage.
Oh, okay. So I didn't catch the drift.
Yeah, we don't have a pit crew or a music crew. We do have the notes and the music and that sort of thing, but it's pretty much a package deal.
Ah. Well, we've been visiting with Terry Wiesner, director of the Red Barn Theater production of Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant. Show runs through June 7th with no performance on this coming Sunday. For ticket information, you may call 715-234-8301 or use your favorite internet search engine to find the Red Barn Theater's webpage. Terry Wiesner, thanks so much for being with us.
No problem.
Here's a Spectrum memo. Tomorrow evening at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee, it's the White Sidewalls at 7:30 p.m. Friday, June 6th, Jazz and Wine at the Mabel, music by Take 2 Day. Later in June, it's The Gales of November, a dramatic musical about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Another musical is coming mid-July the last 5 years. Check on it all at the website, MabelTainter.org. His name is Brent Hensel. He's a Green Bay Packer. You won't find his jersey on the sporting goods rack, but he does a great job on defense. What Brent does is defend and protect and preserve the Packers' past as the new curator of the Packers Hall of Fame. Growing up in Black River Falls, your release talked about being a Packer fan as a kid. I'm sure that continued as you grew. I enjoyed the quote about you saying you were going to work for them one day. That actually happened, huh?
Yes. as a young boy, I dreamed about working for the Green Bay Packers. You know how a lot of kids think about, well, I want to, you know, like, play football for them?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I was a little more realistic. I dreamed more of, I guess, maybe being the general manager and selecting players.
Sure.
But I always have had a love for history, and I've always been interested in Packer history and the history of football and the NFL overall.
So then you went on to UW-Eau Claire, and of course the history thing continued. Did you have the sports/history thing in the back of your mind? Is that something you felt you were going to do with history?
Not necessarily. I have a varied background, as a lot of people do. They find their niche later in life. I actually originally went to the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and got my bachelor's degree there, so I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I always liked history, but I didn't want to teach at the time. I love sports, but I didn't know how could I get in the field. So I eventually actually went back and got my teaching degree, and I actually taught high school social studies for a few years.
Okay.
Eventually decided that I wanted to finish my master's, and I completed my master's degree while at UW-Eau Claire. I met there, who was a big influence on me, one of my professors, John Mann. He mentioned that the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio was doing an internship, so that intrigued me. I guess I had been thinking about what else could I do with history besides teaching. That's when I started looking into museums, and I actually interned at the Chippewa Valley Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got the internship at the Pro Football Hall of Fame, that really started taking me into the direction I am now.
And then you spent some time out east as a Hall of Fame director for the Patriots.
Yes. I was the curator for the New England Patriots, and was a great experience. I could almost term that as a dream-type job. I was out there 7 years. I got to help create and implement their Hall of Fame. I was hired in July of 2006, and it opened in September of 2008.
Good for you. I can see where that would be exciting.
Yes, it was. And typically, a curator doesn't necessarily get to help plan or create exhibits, so being involved on the ground floor was a great experience, and I think it was one of the factors that helped me get this job, since the current Hall of Fame is closed and being renovated and recreated.
On Spectrum West, Brent Hensel, he's curator of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame, and he grew up in western Wisconsin. You know what I like about this story is that it shows not only me, but it shows others how diverse one can be with a history education. Kind of puts a neat light on history as a career. I'm picturing young people out there going, wow, I guess I never thought that being a professional football Hall of Fame curator is history. It makes history kind of cool.
Exactly. Well, I remember asking my professors at UW-Eau Claire, what else can I do with a history background besides teach? And they talked about, like, public history. Not only do football teams or sports organizations have Hall of Fames or museums, but there are corporations that sometimes hire historians that they're looking to preserve their history.
Now, as you mentioned, the Packer Hall is closed and undergoing a renovation. So it appears you picked a great time to jump in, as you did for the Patriots. Is this something that you can put the Hensel touch on to the new exhibit?
I've had my share of ideas, but there's a team involved that's, I don't know, you may have recently seen Cliff Kristol has been hired as the Packers historian.
Mm-hmm. Was he a newspaper guy?
Yes.
Okay.
He's covered the Packers for the Green Bay Press Gazette, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I don't know his entire background, but he's covered the Packers going back into the Lombardi years. So I don't know if I've met anyone that knows more about the Packers than Cliff.
Well, you might be in those shoes someday. Someone will say that about you.
Well, I hope so. I've tried to be a sponge and learn as much as I can from him.
This came to mind as I was thinking about you and I chatting. Does a historian feel, and I put feel in quotes, what it is that he's asked to communicate to the public? I mean, is it imperative for you to truly understand what and who's behind the legacy that you have to protect?
Yes, I think so. I mean, one of the big themes that we've really tried to look at that we want to convey in the new Hall of Fame is we want to tell the Packers story and how we think maybe it's the greatest sports story ever. There's a lot of great teams out there in all sports, but it's pretty amazing that a small city like Green Bay, Wisconsin, can still have a football team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's really no story out there in professional sports like it. I don't know how many of your listeners know how many small-town teams there were in the National Football League in the 1920s that actually either won NFL titles or played in the title game. The Canton Bulldogs, the Providence Steamroller, Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, all these teams were at the top of the standings, and they eventually died off even by the 1930s. And yet, even though the Packers have had their own financial struggles, it's a pretty amazing story that they've survived and are still going strong in the NFL today.
Today, Brent, things seem all about presentation and color and noise. I have the privilege of at least going to one Packer game a year, and to me they can seem like a pinball game sometimes. I mean, with all the lights and the music and the non-football distractions going on, how much glitz are people like you and the team that's putting the Hall of Fame together expected to inject in an historical exhibit to make it appealing to the public?
We definitely discuss it. We actually always talk about two things. We want to find a right mix for a museum or a Hall of Fame, and we want to appeal to all audiences. The fan that's a young boy or girl that's 7 or 8 years old, all the way to an elderly person. And so we talk about having a mix of the great Packer history. We have great artifacts, but we also talk about reaching today's audience, so having a mix of media and interactives. And then we really want to make sure we get the story right.
And the new hall is going to be in the stadium, in the atrium, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
It eventually moved into the Lambeau Field atrium in 2003 when they did the first set of renovations.
Okay.
And then now it's being changed a little bit. It was kind of on the basement level. Mm-hmm. Now it will be on two levels on the atrium floor.
Originally, it was part of the Brown County Arena, wasn't it, way back when?
That is correct.
Once the Hall of Fame is finished, give us an idea of what a day in the life of a curator is. When you really don't have to spend a lot of time looking over plans and planning a brand new building. When it settles down, what's it like?
Well, I don't know if there's ever like a typical day for me what I'm going to be doing, but some of what I do, we're always planning for the future.
Mm-hmm.
The actually 100th anniversary of the Packers from them starting in 1919 is not that far away.
Right.
One of the things we want to do with the Hall of Fame, a lot of people go to a museum and they see it once and they think, well, I've seen everything, why should I go back? We're always trying to keep it fresh. We have a couple temporary exhibits that we will change out on an annual basis. So that's part of my job, help plan for those future exhibits. And then also, a player sets an NFL record on Sunday, we can get like a piece of equipment, whether it's their cleats or the football,
Oh, sure.
And put it on display, and so you can see it right away. So we're always thinking about trying to keep it so the visitor sees something new each time they come to visit.
Yeah, that makes sense. Most museums have huge storage areas. And do you get people calling saying, I have this and it belonged to him and would you like it?
We get some calls. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely working on a new storage facility. Obviously, we can't display all the artifacts. I guess really organizing and inventorying the collection because the Packers actually did not have a curator previously.
Very, very interesting stuff. Brent Hensel, I appreciate you being with us here on Spectrum West. Congratulations on the new gig. It sounds like fun.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering fixed-rate mortgages, adjustable-rate mortgages, WIDA, and federal VA loans for homebuyers refinancing or building. WisconsinCU.org.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant will play through June 7th at the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake. There is no performance on June 1st. The Old Gem Theater production of Charlotte's Web will be available for groups through June 6th at the Old Gem in New Richmond. That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers, will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will play Fridays and Saturdays and selected Sundays through August 14th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I am Jim Holliver.
Yes, you are. Thank you, sir. Here's a Spectrum memo on Spectrum West. Tuesday Night Blues at Owen Park in Eau Claire gets underway. It is underway. June 3rd, that's next Tuesday, the Sue Orfield Band. Wow. Music starts at 6:30.
This instrument was called a Paul Bunyan harp, made out of a piece of birch tree, made by an old time logger, lumberjack from Ladysmith, Wisconsin. His name is Dave Mathers, a direct descendant of Cotton Mathers. It is tuned A, D, G, and C as a tenor banjo, used in the northern Wisconsin lumber camps.
That's an old recording of Ray Calkins and the Shanty Boy tune. It was sent to us by Jim Leary, who's done a lot of work at UW-Madison over a long and illustrious career as an authority of Scandinavian studies. He's authored volumes on it and related topics and has helped us, Wisconsin, preserve rare, time-worn recordings. Plus, he's always found the time and passion to teach in the Department of Comparative Literature and Folklore Studies. He's traveled a bit, too, to become a specialist that he is today, beginning with South Bend, Indiana. So you went to Notre Dame. How do you settle on Scandinavian studies when you're at the Irish?
Well, I'm Irish-American, but I grew up in Rice Lake, where there are a lot of Norwegians.
I had to look it up to see exactly. I mean, I had an idea what is considered Scandinavian countries. I was surprised to see that Iceland was in there.
Well, sure, yeah. Dissident Norwegians settled Iceland in the 9th century, and so the, you know, they speak a Scandinavian language, and there's a really strong kind of Viking heritage in Iceland.
Well, UW-Madison, it would take up a good portion, I think, of this conversation to list your educational distinctions and your fellowships and your awards and scholarships. So let's define you this way. For over 40 years, you've researched traditional songs, stories, customary practices, and craftsmanship of indigenous and immigrant people, along with their mostly rural and working-class descendants in the upper Midwest. Is that fair?
That is correct.
Let's talk about the early days. I read that you were fascinated with the diverse customs of those around whom you grew up in Rice Lake, Wisconsin. Now, when we're young, we sometimes get bitten by the history bug and have a stretch where we soak it up in volumes. But in you, that appetite continued. Was there a point at which you resigned yourself to a life dedicated to satisfying that appetite?
Well, yeah, I think so. In 73, I got my master's degree in folklore at the University of North Carolina. My dad gave me $50, and I spent half on beer, but the other
good for you, I say.
The other half, I bought a tape recorder and went back home to Rice Lake and went down the road to an old Irish American guy who'd been a neighbor. He was born in 1885. His folks were immigrants from Ireland, and he'd worked in the woods, and he knew a lot of great traditional stories, old, some of the oldest Ole and Lena jokes, you know, yeah, from like about 1900. And he also knew about old, different old-time fiddlers, French, Canadian, and Irish in the area. And, you know, it was just kind of thrilling to me. And so I've never looked back.
So you got your master's degree with the intent of teaching it?
Yeah, what I really wanted to do was to do research on the folklore of diverse peoples in the upper Midwest. And, okay, and sure, then I was happy to teach. But I also love doing things like I've worked on exhibits, produced radio programs, produced sound recordings, worked on film. So, I like to be involved with actively doing research and turning it into something that gives it back to the community.
You brought it up, the Ole and Lena joke. Is there history to that?
Oh, sure there is, yeah. Yeah. Norwegians began coming to the upper Midwest as early as the 1830s, but in the late 19th century, there was a second wave of them along with a bunch of Swedes who began to immigrate in big numbers. Mm-hmm. And these jokes, which were told in English, although in broken English with the Scandinavian dialect, had to do with, you know, the experience of newcomers in a new world. And initially they were enjoyed a lot by the Norwegian and Swedish Americans who already had been here for a while and were established. So in some ways they were seeing themselves or their parents in these these newcomers who were coming. And then I think they began to catch on. So we know that they started as early as the 1890s or late 1880s. And initially they had to do with just, you know, people coming into the country, the immigrant generation. But if we look at these jokes today, they've kind of changed with the time. So they're relatively contemporary jokes about Ole and Lena in the modern world. They become part of the regional culture, at least in parts of the upper Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Is Wisconsin and Minnesota, is that the mother lode of Scandinavian ethnicity in America?
Pretty strongly so. Swedes, especially Minneapolis and in the St. Croix Valley, and Norwegians kind of in southern and southwestern and western Wisconsin, overlapping over into Minnesota, and then there, the Finnish American homeland is kind of stretches from the upper peninsula of Michigan across northern Wisconsin and up through Duluth up toward the Iron Range and the North Shore of Minnesota. So that, yeah, we're the most Scandinavian region in the country.
But you've collected so much stuff, and we're going to listen to a tune a little later, but I have to try to imagine what it was like for you before the internet. A lot of traveling and phone calls and wow.
Yeah, well, there still is. You know, when you go out to do field work, you try to find people who are good musicians or storytellers or good at doing handwork, and it's a lot of hard work. And nowadays, you're right, it's a lot easier, but still, you've got to go out and meet people. You can't do it sitting on your tail and working on the computer.
On the phone with us, James Leary. He's an authority on Scandinavian studies, author on prevalent ethnicities in Wisconsin and the Midwest, and a collector of rare, time-worn recordings, among many other things. I'm going to speculate, Jim, that you've been instrumental in cataloging much of what is now available online relative to what it is you do and what you've uncovered.
Yeah, I direct what's called the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and what we're linguists and folklorists, and we're committed to research, collections development, and public programs about the languages and folklore of diverse people in the region. So, yeah, we do work a lot trying to build documentary collections and making them organized and available.
I don't know why this is a pleasant surprise to me, because Madison is so impressive, the university system and campus. But it's rather refreshing for me to know that UW-Madison has a folklore program and an impressive music library.
Well, I'm very happy about it, too. There aren't a lot of folklore programs in the country.
Oh, good.
We do have a good one here, and a number of us have been dedicated to the diverse cultures in the region. Mm-hmm. So it is thrilling for me anyway.
This is a good time to let our audience hear a song from the 30s or 40s, and it has to do with a community in the heart of our Western Wisconsin grandstand. He doesn't call it Chippewa Falls. Charles Cardinal calls it something else. Give us a little bit of a preview of the song we're going to hear.
Well, this is a local parody of the French kind of quasi-national anthem, the Soldier Song, or the Marseillaise, okay, sung by Charles Cardinal, who grew up in Chippewa Falls. And it mentions the number of local people, Mose Sarrazin, Felix Cardinal, Charles' father, Johnny Thériault, Johnny Martineau, and Pete Legault, who was a local character and a logger in this version of the Marseillaise, French-Canadian.
Now, folks, I would like to tell you something about in the early 1900s, oh, I should judge about 1906 or 7, I run across a French-Canadian old lumberjack. And he met me one evening in the old saloon days, and he says, how do you do? Your name is Cardinal, ain't it? I says, yes, sir, it is. Well, he says, you know, Mr. Cardinal, I'm used to know your father pretty well. And I know your uncle, too, used to keep the hotel. And say, you know, Mr. Cardinal, I'm like told you something. You know how they sing the Marseillaise in Chippewa Falls? I says, no, I do not. Well, he says, this is the way they sing the Marseillaise in Chippewa Falls. Old Mose Sarrazin and Felix Cardinal, Johnny Thériault and Johnny Martineau, likewise old Pete Legault.
Now, you were kind enough to send along a CD of songs whose substance rises from our West Wisconsin neighborhood. Recordings like this, I know that you've gone out and done field recordings, but these are old ones. Are they scarce, or can you find them readily?
Well, these are field recordings that were made by Helene Stratman Thomas in the 1940s, and she was a music instructor at University of Wisconsin-Madison who was encouraged by the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress to make field recordings in the region. And so she did, traveled all around with a big disc-cutting equipment and a sound engineer. She recorded over 700 songs and tunes in more than 25 languages.
Wow.
And actually, you can listen to all of them with real player. The Mills Music Library at University of Wisconsin has put the entire collection online. So if people search for the Helene, that's like Helen with an E, Stratman Thomas, a hyphenated name, collection, you can find it, and then you can either browse or you can search, you know, search by ethnic group or instrument or song type or something.
It's very cool. I'm trying to imagine her process of finding all these people and then recording them.
Yeah, she did some talks over public radio. They sent out newspaper stories. Sometimes she relied on students at UW-Madison whose parents or relatives were Czech or Croatian or Austrian or something like that. And so then she accumulated a kind of a list of people and set out in the summer on a trip. And sometimes along the way, she found out about other people as well. So it was kind of by hook or by crook. It wasn't as systematic as it might have been, but given that it was just, you know, one person with the whole state to cover back in the day,
yeah,
was rather an amazing job.
Have people over time diluted things? Does history rewrite itself and you have to say, hey, wait, you're not getting that right?
Well, I'm not a purist. I think things are always changing and combining different kinds of ways, and I guess I'm just curious about seeing what happens. But for my part, I'm also excited if I can make some of these older recordings available to younger people who might want to play these songs, mm-hmm, or pursue some more background about them. I'm kind of content to just see what happens, but also to do my part.
Tell me briefly about the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. Is that a place?
I guess we're most visible online. This summer we're moving into new offices on the fourth floor of the University Club, which is on the campus mall at UW-Madison. We're also there with the Max Kata Institute for German-American Studies. And so once we get moved in, we will have some small exhibits, but mostly we're doing projects and we try to create an online presence for them, and then we collaborate with different organizations on exhibits and films and the like.
And where do people go to access that?
csumc.wisc.edu, I think. but it's Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, or CSUMC.
Uh-huh.
I think you can also get something like Central Springs United Methodist Church if you Googled. But you'll also find a link for us.
Well, we'll keep trying. This is public radio at its best. I mean, this is most fascinating, and it's what Spectrum West is all about. It's been a lot of fun, and thanks, James Leary, for being with us.
My pleasure, Al. It's a delight.
Come, gira, come, gira, er cameret giro tarde. Oh, neida, mamma patanok meida.
And from the archives we talked about, that was Alice Everson from Blair, Wisconsin, way back when. The website he imparted is correct. It is csumc.wisc.edu. That'll get you there. Spectrum Memo, the Artmobile, arrives Saturday at Phoenix Park in Eau Claire from the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center and various sponsors. It's available for young people on Wednesdays from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's June 11th through August 27th. Thursdays from 1 to 5 p.m., June 12th through August 28th. And Saturdays through September 20th from 7:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. And at the Volume 1 Sounds Like Summer Concert Series. The big ECRAC Jubilee Masquerade Ball is next Thursday, 6 p.m., Florian Gardens. That's cool. What else can I tell you about? Young people ages 2 to 18 invited to enter the 4th Northern Wisconsin Show Us Your Talent Contest. Official rules and entry forms available at ecct.org or northernwisconsinstatefair.com. Hey, next week we're going to welcome Roy Ryman, well-known publisher of Made in Wisconsin periodicals like Taste of Home. And today, Our Wisconsin, we'll talk about his career and his inability to enjoy retirement without publishing something. The Eau Claire Municipal Band is filling the summer air again. Young musicians are making their annual pilgrimage to Shell Lake again this summer. And more, always more, coming up next week on Spectrum West. My name is Al Ross. Thanks to everybody who helps put this program together. I'll see you next week.